I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. SEPTA finally announced that its new payment system, SEPTA Key, will begin a multi-phase rollout in June. After years of delays, a pilot program for the new fare card will launch Monday, June 13th. SEPTA Deputy General Manager Rich Burnfield says up to 10,000 SEPTA Key cards will be available to the public on a first-come, first-served basis at 13 locations.
Six locations on the Market Frankford line, six locations on the Broad Street subway line, and at SEPTA's headquarters at 1234 Market Street.
During the initial pilot, the SEPTA Key will only replace weekly and monthly transit passes. It won't work on regional rail, and it won't replace tokens. Burnfield couldn't say how long the pilot will last, so for most passengers, the wait will continue at least a few more months. The Philadelphia School District is turning thumbs down on four neighborhood-based charter schools that are seeking renewal. As WHYY's Kevin McCory reports, leaders say the schools are not making the cut academically.
The district turned over operations at Vare Elementary and Auden Reed High School to Universal Charter in 2011. It gave control of Alani High School to a Spirit Charter in that year, too, and Stetson Middle School in 2010. Now, the district is recommending that the School Reform Commission not renew those arrangements. Dawn Lynn Kaser is executive director of the district's charter office. She says charters in the Renaissance program are held to higher standards and that academic results at all four schools have been underwhelming.
In fact, at Vare, there was a 10 percentage point decrease in math proficiency from the last year in which it was operated by the district.
Kaser also cited issues with the long and short-term fiscal health of the four schools. Both Universal and Aspira say they will fight the recommendations and hope to convince the SRC to vote in their interest at an action meeting at the end of the month. Universal CEO George Burrell stressed the cultural shifts they've made at both of their schools, sharply reducing violent incidents, enough to leave the state's persistently dangerous list.
The disruption that will occur if these decisions are upheld by the School Reform Commission just don't seem to be worth it. Given where the schools are today.
The district is giving the green light to five other charters seeking renewal, including three mastery schools. At that late April meeting, the SRC will also vote on whether three traditional district schools should become Renaissance charters next year. Kevin McCory, WHYY News.
The April 26th Democratic primary in Pennsylvania for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Republican Pat Toomey is heating up. The environment is one of the main topics the candidates have been talking about. The big issue, fracking, as Reed Frazier of the Allegheny Front reports.
Fracking may have fueled an energy boom in the U.S., but these days it's also fueling campaign rhetoric among the Democrats seeking to supplant Pat Toomey this fall. Former Congressman and Navy Rear Admiral Joe Sestak and Braddock Mayor John Fetterman have both called for a moratorium on fracking, at least until regulations get tighter. Here's Sestak talking recently on WPSU's Take Note.
I'm for a moratorium on fracking because how can you ever do something where the Solicitor General has said our Department of Energy Protection wasn't prepared to oversee the drilling and it didn't have the proper regulations nor the enforcement of it, and therefore you see where our drinking water is being damaged.
He was referring to a 2014 Pennsylvania Auditor General's report that found inconsistent and inadequate enforcement of the fracking industry from the state's Department of Environmental Protection. Sestak and Fetterman's opponent, Katie McGinty, once headed that agency in the early days of Pennsylvania's gas boom. At a recent debate among the three candidates in Pittsburgh on WTAE-TV, she accused Sestak of flip-flopping on fracking.
Congressman Sestak, in his book, that is the foundation of his campaign, calls fracking the common good and actually waves regulators off to not step on that rustic spirit and pioneering spirit of our energy developers.
While his book makes no mention of a call for a moratorium, he has called for one as far back as 2010. Sestak writes in the book that fracking for natural gas could yield positive results, like lowering carbon emissions. But he says, quote, it must not be done at a greater cost or even damage to our Commonwealth. At the debate, it was McGuinty's record on fracking that came under attack from both Sestak and Fetterman. They zeroed in on McGuinty's record as former DEP secretary under Governor Ed Rendell. Here's Fetterman.
I pointed out that we actually have an expert on the stage this evening on fracking because Ms. McGuinty really, along with Governor Rendell, brought fracking to Pennsylvania.
McGuinty says tight regulations on the industry are needed, but not a moratorium. She defended her record of promoting clean energy both at the DEP and later in the private sector. She also tried to fend off attempts to tie her to fracking because she received campaign donations from individuals who work in the industry.
Bottom line is, I am supported by the solar industry, the wind industry. I am not supported by the frackers and drillers.
Fetterman and Sestak criticized McGuinty's work in the private sector with energy companies she had once regulated after leaving the DEP. McGuinty said her private sector work gave her real-world experience that her opponents don't have and that she was proud that she wasn't just, quote, a creature of government. The primary is April 26th. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
These are taxing times for Americans. Let's attach numbers to the notions with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, tax day, Monday, April 18th. Let's get right to it. What percentage of Americans say they're not paying enough in federal taxes?
3%. How's that for a number?
I always wait each year for that number.
That's right. 3% of us, and I'm not sure who they are, say the amount of federal income taxes they pay is too low. 57% say what they pay is too high. And it's an important point. That had been around the 50% level for a number of years now after the Bush tax cuts. But for whatever reason, and I think it probably comes back to the political campaigning, there's been a jump this year from 50% to 57% who say the amount of taxes they pay is too high.
I'm guessing this divides along party lines to an extent.
Clearly, the presidential candidates are divided. Bernie Sanders, one of the central motifs of his whole campaign this year is wealth and income inequality. He calls strongly for higher taxes on higher income Americans and also increased estate taxes and other ways to extract money from the well-to-do. Hillary Clinton, although not as extreme in her positions, clearly also says that taxes should be increased on the wealthy. And then you've got the Republicans. Both Cruz and Trump end up, I think, saying that taxes should go down. You know, they propose simplified tax systems and this, that, and the other. But when you look at it, Cruz, for example, says that all taxpayers will pay less taxes under his plan if he were elected.
Now let's move beyond too much, too little to fair or unfair.
Same basic pattern. Right now, half of Americans say the amount of taxes they pay is fair. And that's an important question because Gallup first asked that when World War II was raging. You remember well, back in February and March of 1943, 85% of Americans said the taxes they paid to the federal government were fair. And I think that's because they had the war effort going on. They thought the money was being put to good use. In fact, that even rose to 90%, Dave, in February of 1944 during the war. But then this year, it's dropped back down again. Americans a little more negative about their taxes.
As we're focusing on taxes, is that a major issue for Americans starting April 19th?
It is not. If you look at our most important problem question, which we ask every month, we just updated it through Sunday. Taxes are very low. Just about 3% of Americans mention either taxes or the fact that we have income inequality in this country. Anything surrounding that issue is a very low percentage of Americans who mention it. Earlier this year, we talked about having asked Americans, what are your priorities for the presidential candidates to be talking about, and inequality in taxes actually show fairly low on that as well. So although the candidates talk a lot about taxes, at least top of mind is not a high priority issue for Americans.
Frank, you cited Bernie Sanders. He lent his support to striking Verizon workers this week, much to the consternation of that organization's CEO. What are Americans' attitudes around unions?
We've asked that question for many, many decades, and the last time we asked it, 58% of Americans said they approve of labor unions, and it's been consistently in majority territory for many years now. That's intriguing because only 12% of working Americans themselves today that we interview say they are members of labor unions. So the percent who are members of unions has come down significantly over the years. Again, the vast majority of workers aren't union members, but hey, over half of Americans say, in general, they're positive about the union mission.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. Still ahead this evening, we'll wonder why vinyl records seem to be flourishing amid the digital music marketplace.
I believe that the vinyl is the single most important audio piece in the marketplace for a lot of these artists.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. This weekend, a dilapidated cemetery in West Philadelphia is the stage for a play based on the ancient story of Beowulf. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the play is part of an effort to turn around the fortunes of the cemetery.
For most people, Beowulf was something they had to read in high school.
I have to say that it's not my favorite story. It's perhaps not one of the high school moments that I'm most connected to.
Maura Kraus is a theater director, and it wasn't her idea to do Beowulf.
But I do really love cemeteries. I love historic cemeteries, kind of these wild places. The juxtaposition of the stone and the overgrowth just really gets me.
Kraus was asked by the Renegade Theater Company to direct Beowulf here in the Mount Moriah Cemetery. It's a 200-acre burial ground in southwest Philadelphia. It was established in 1855. That's before the Civil War. But in recent decades, it has been neglected. Headstones are toppled or missing. Many have just disappeared in the overgrowth. The play is a walking play, so audiences follow the actors as they meander a mile through the cemetery, performing the story of the ancient hero Beowulf confronting the monster Grendel. But Kraus messes with the story a bit by narrowing that gap between hero and monster. It's ambiguous which is which. A third character, the narrator, confronts the two other characters to get on with it already.
Ugh, tell me someone's gonna get their arm ripped off pretty soon.
What?
Well, that's what the story's all about. Either your sinews unravel until your shoulder bone cracks and you lose an arm, or you get an arm and you put it up on the rafters and it victoriously drips over all your false friends as you face your own mortality.
Spoiler alert, nobody's arm is ripped off. Not literally, anyway.
Yes.
And that's the way the cemetery prefers it. The Friends of Mount Moriah Cemetery is a group of volunteers who started maintaining the land after it was abandoned in 2004. That's when the last member of the Mount Moriah Cemetery Association died, leaving behind no money and no people to govern the property. In 2014, the state of Pennsylvania named the newly formed Mount Moriah Preservation Corporation as custodian. Now, the president of the Friends group, Paulette Roan, wants to program the acreage with events to make it a destination for the living. She has a few caveats.
There will be no walking and traipsing over graves. There will be no blood and gore, nothing that is at all disrespectful to those who are buried there or the families who may come to visit.
This is the first play performed at Mount Moriah, and Roan is watching the production carefully to make sure Beowulf is not too Beowulf. And that's okay with the director. Kraus wants this play to be less about tearing off an arm and more about the legacies of heroes and monsters.
We have to stick with kind of this question of a fight, of bodies, of ancestry, of making choices, and of telling stories about ourselves.
I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
For the past 9 years, the third Saturday of April has become a day of celebration for music lovers with the rise of Record Store Day, an invitation for record collectors worldwide to support local music stores, with musicians large and small cutting limited edition vinyl releases for the occasion. Now, each of those records had humble beginnings as a pile of tiny vinyl pebbles. And NewsWorks Tonight traveled to Independent Record Pressing in Bordentown, New Jersey, to learn exactly how those pellets are turned into music. Sean Rakowski is general manager of the pressing plant, and he let us in on the process.
So there wouldn't be a annual Record Store Day if not for the ramp up of record production. And so, Sean, what does it take in 2016 to make a record at your operation?
Well, we need to make sure we've got great music. The artist to make the music and to get it pressed, get it mastered, and then they take it somewhere to be a lacquer to be cut, which is the first step of the vinyl process. From that lacquer, masters and mothers are made. A mother is the piece that makes all the stampers, which are a reverse image of the record.
And analogous to what many suppose Cuba has been like without the infiltration of commerce from the U.S. and the dilapidated cars and such, is anybody making new equipment to make new records, or are they all borrowed and used componentry?
There are some new presses being made currently. I think they're being made out of Germany. From what I can see, it's a lot of the same technology that the current presses have. It's just with all newer parts and a little bit more automation.
Independent opened last year, 2015.
Yes, we got into the building in the end of February 2015. We did the build-out of the facility, got all the permits and everything, and started production in August, September, in terms of turning on the presses, running some light production, and really started ramping up in October, November, December.
So the resurgent interest in vinyl was well underway, but in your limited time, is that interest continuing to expand?
Yeah, I mean, when I first started a year ago, 1,500 units would be a pretty regular order. I see those 1,500 units are now 3,000 units.
So, Sean, here we are at this big container of vinyl pellets, as it were. How does it go from that to a finished product?
The pellets are then dropped into what's called an extruder, and what that does is heats the pellets up to, say, a toothpaste-like consistency. It gets squirted into a cup, which is about the shape of a hockey puck, or that we call a biscuit.
There's two stampers that have the image of the record on it.
A side, B side?
Side, yep, squashed with a label on it. The label's already put on it. And then it's squashed like a big waffle iron.
The rough edges get trimmed off, and then it's ready to play. It's funny, when we first started, we got a lot of people who are applying. A lot of people come in thinking if they've run a machine, they can run this. But it's really much different. It's not just walking in front of a machine, pressing a button, and sort of just keeping an eye on it or making a few adjustments. There's a lot of moving around with the presses.
Truly in part a craft or an art.
It really is. I mean, especially with these older machines, stuff always can go wrong with them. Stuff can always happen.
What that does is, whoa.
Back up. Another marketing enticement I've seen is, 180 gram vinyl? What's the advantage of that versus something that has a different weight?
I think right now vinyl is such a tactile experience that having a 180 gram in your hands versus a 130 or 140, you can feel a difference. It's a media record.
To what extent does that tactile experience inform this entire resurgence and love of vinyl from, say, just getting a download?
Digital has really been the best thing for the resurgence of vinyl.
How so?
Well, just because digital takes out the tactile thing, people realize if they're really emotionally connected to music, they want a piece of that somehow. They want to experience it.
Who are some of the artists that you work with, and how do they substantiate a desire to have their product come out in part on vinyl?
Mainly what we're pressing here is a pretty wide range. I call it the Brooklyn hipster to the Warped Tour stuff. But really, it's a little bit of everything. I mean, I'm looking at Mavis Staples, quintessential gospel artist.
Sometimes life can get you in a hurry, but...
Prism Tats, which is more electronic dance. Mac DeMarco, that's an independent artist. I believe that the vinyl is the single most important audio piece in the marketplace for a lot of these artists, meaning... if there's a little tick in a vinyl or it doesn't sound the way that they feel their customer wants, or that if a record gets out into the marketplace without a download card, we're going to hear about it. If you go to stream something and it buffers, you just kind of deal with it and move on. People don't do that with vinyl.
You're relatively new. What are your goals or plans for, say, fiscal 2017?
Our goal is, and I tell the staff this every single day, is just to continue making something a little bit better than the day before. improving the process, improving efficiency, making a better sounding record, making a better feeling record, making a better looking record. I think there's plenty of opportunities every day to be better than the previous day. We just really right now want to focus on just making good basic vinyl.
Well, Sean, thank you for your time.
I appreciate you guys coming by.
Sean Rakowski, General Manager of Independent Record Pressing, and you can hear much more of our conversation and see plenty of pictures at newsworks.org.
Sometimes people try to take all they can from you, but they don't call.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production this week from Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Song. At the controls this week, Al Banks and Diana Martinez. John Mussoni is acting Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online, but not on vinyl, at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.